Greetings and welcome to the Pieris Pharmaceuticals 2015 year-end conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Darlene Deptula-Hicks. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Brenda, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for our 2015 year-end earnings conference call. With me here today is Stephen Yoder, Chief Executive Officer. We announced financial results yesterday on March 22, 2016, after the market closed for the year ended December 31, 2015. You can access the press release on the Investor Relations page of our website. Before we begin to review financial results and business highlights, in compliance with the Safe Harbor provisions under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, I would like to caution that comments made during this conference call by management may contain forward-looking statements that involve risks and uncertainties regarding the operations and future results and operations of Pieris, including statements relating to the timing and progress of our clinical and preclinical trials. Actual results or events may differ materially from results or events discussed in the forward-looking statements. Factors that might cause such differences include those set forth from time to time in the company's filings with the SEC, including, without limitation, the company's forms 10-K, 10-Q, and 8-K. Furthermore, the content of this conference call contains time-sensitive information that is accurate only as of the date of this live broadcast, March 23, 2016. Pieris undertakes no obligation to revise or update any statements to reflect events or circumstances after the date of this conference call. With that, I will now hand the call over to Stephen Yoder, CEO.
Thank you, Darlene, and good morning to everyone. We appreciate you joining us for this year-end update call. Fiscal year 2015 was one of significant progress for Pieris Pharmaceuticals, and we ended the year on very solid ground. Among the several highlights from last year, we signed our first immuno-oncology collaboration, which is with Roche, an oncology leader. We completed a public offering of common stock, raising more than $28 million in gross proceeds. We presented positive phase 1 data from our lead Anticalin therapeutic program, PRS-080, which represents the fastest path to achieve clinical proof of concept for the Anticalin drug class. We also made several key personnel appointments as we opened our U.S. headquarters in Boston and increasingly focused on the development of our fully proprietary Anticalin pipeline. These appointments include Dr. Louis Matus as Senior Vice President and Chief Development Officer, Darlene Deptula-Hicks as Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, and Dr. Jean-Pierre Bizzari as a member of our Board of Directors. On today's call, we want to provide a more thorough review of our 2015 accomplishments, our key objectives for 2016, an overview of our year-end earnings, and this will be followed by a question and answer session. As an intro, I want to remind everyone that Pieris Pharmaceuticals is a clinical stage biotechnology company advancing our fully proprietary next generation therapeutic protein drug class, which we call anticalins. Our strategy is to deploy anticalins to treat diseases in ways that other drug modalities, such as monoclonal antibodies, cannot do so well, if at all. And there are two key points I'd like you to remember today about anticalins. First, they have excellent drug-like properties, as they are derived from non-immunogenic natural human proteins. Second, they're differentiated from other drug classes while at the same time being highly synergistic with established drug classes, especially monoclonal antibodies, as I hope you'll see in our immuno-oncology franchise. As we continue to develop the anticalins, we are managing risk by diversifying across two fronts. First, we're pursuing a diversified pipeline of both proprietary and partner programs, together with several large pharma partners who fully fund these novel programs and at the same time have milestone potential of more than $700 million plus royalties on sales of drug product. Second, we are diversified within our fully proprietary pipeline, focusing on multiple therapeutic areas of major unmet clinical need that we believe will benefit from the unique clinical potential of anticalins. This includes our novel multi-specific proteins in the area of immuno-oncology, and inhaled biologics for respiratory disorders such as severe allergic asthma. We made significant progress across our proprietary and partnered pipeline in 2015, and I want to begin by highlighting the key developments in our proprietary pipeline. Our most advanced program is PRS-080. This is a half-life optimized Anticalin to address anemia by antagonizing hepcidin. It's a target generally regarded as a master negative regulator of iron metabolism. Hepcidin, which can be significantly upregulated in states of chronic inflammation, traps iron in storage cells, which hinders the body's ability to create an adequate supply of red blood cells, which causes what is called functional iron deficient anemia. And by antagonizing hepcidin, PRS-080 is intended to liberate this trapped iron for use in erythropoiesis. Importantly, PRS-080 again represents the fastest path to potentially demonstrate clinical proof of concept for our Anticalin technology by assessing the ability to increase hemoglobin levels, which is an established clinical endpoint in patients with anemia of chronic disease. We believe we're on track to assess this endpoint by the middle of 2017 in our targeted patient population, namely patients with chronic kidney disease undergoing hemodialysis, many of whom suffer from functional iron deficient anemia. In 2015, we completed a blinded placebo-controlled phase 1 clinical trial for PRS-080 in healthy volunteers. These clinical data were presented last December at the 2015 ASH conference, the annual meeting of the American Society of Hematology. The data there demonstrated the favorable safety profile of the drug candidate and proof of mechanism. In particular, PRS-080 was well tolerated by the 48 healthy male subjects and had no serious adverse events. And among all subjects receiving PRS-080 at doses from 1.2 mg per kg or higher in the six-dose study, we observed statistically significant increases in total serum iron mobilization, the intended mode of action, relative to placebo. As a next step, PRS is pursuing a first-in-patient trial in end-stage renal disease patients exhibiting functional iron deficient anemia. This single ascending dose trial is expected to be completed by the end of 2016, followed by a multi-dose trial that involves dosing over 4 weeks, which we believe is sufficient to assess the ability of PRS-080 to impact hemoglobin levels. Currently, we believe we can complete this multi-dose trial around the middle of 2017. Next, we turn to our inhaled Anticalin program, PRS-060, to treat uncontrolled asthmatics by antagonizing a clinically validated target, IL-4 receptor alpha, directly in the lung. We believe that a local or topical approach may bring a number of advantages over subcutaneously administered antibody approaches, including the potential for a significantly lower dose, low systemic target engagement, lower cost of goods, and increased convenience. In September of last year, positive preclinical data on the program were presented at the annual European Respiratory Society annual meeting by Professor Gary Anderson, who's a professor of pharmacology and the director of the Lung Health Research Center at the University of Melbourne. In preclinical studies, PRS-060 has demonstrated both time-dependent and concentration-dependent antagonism of IL-4 receptor alpha-mediated signaling in a transgenic mouse model of disease through inhalation, very low in silico-predicted immunogenicity, and technical feasibility for inhalation as both a wet aerosol and dry powder. This program currently is in IND-enabling studies, and the initiation of a first-in-man clinical trial is anticipated for the first half of 2017. As previously mentioned, we plan to carry out initial clinical studies with a nebulized Anticalin formulation, but plan to cross over to a dry powder formulation after demonstrating initial clinical benefit in a first-in-patient study. In terms of project leadership, one of our key management team additions in 2015 was Dr. Mary Fitzgerald, who joined as Vice President of Respiratory Medicine and whose more than 30 years of experience in developing respiratory drugs brings excellent project leadership for PRS 060. Last but certainly not least is our growing immuno-oncology pipeline, which is showcased by our lead program, PRS-343. PRS is highly committed to developing differentiated multispecifics in the area of immuno-oncology. It's an area where we made significant progress in 2015, and we believe this can be a key value driver in 2016. So our lead program, PRS-343, it's a bivalent, bispecific fusion protein targeted CD137 on T cells and the HER2 protein expressed on tumor cells. This bispecific fusion protein is comprised of an agonistic CD137 targeted Anticalin, which is genetically linked, so at the DNA level, to a HER2 targeting antibody. As a target, CD137 is a co-stimulatory immunoreceptor, particularly important in the activation of T cells. We believe CD137 is a promising target in cancer, yet it's one where traditional antibody approaches have struggled to find a therapeutic window through selective activation of tumor-specific T cells without having excessive systemic immune activation, which has led to high levels of toxicity. To overcome the limitations of such systemic toxicity that has been observed in patients treated with anti-CD137 antibody, we designed PRS-343 to promote CD137-based activation of T cells at the site of the tumor in HER2-positive tumor cells. We believe our approach will allow for the potent local activation of tumor-specific T cells with a manageable systemic toxicity profile. In 2015, we presented at high-profile R&D conferences a strong body of preclinical data showing both a desired pharmacodynamic effect and excellent drug-like properties for PRS-343, including conferences such as the inaugural CRI Immuno-Oncology Conference last September and the CITSI and the Triple Conferences last November. Importantly, at AACR next month, we will present publicly the first in vivo proof of concept data for PRS-343 in a preclinical mouse model, which we believe shows evidence for both tumor-localized co-stimulatory T-cell activation and an enhanced therapeutic index compared to an anti-CD137 antibody. Based on the data we have generated, we are pleased to have nominated a development candidate in the fourth quarter of 2015 for PRS-343, and we are proceeding with IND-enabling studies with the objective of initiating a first-in-patient clinical trial under IND in the first half of 2017. Last month, we had a positive pre-IND meeting with FDA, having aligned with FDA on a toxicology strategy, drug release protocol, and general first-in-human trial design. We plan to investigate the activity of 343 in patient populations having a very high unmet medical need, which includes HER2-positive gastrointestinal cancers, invasive bladder cancer, and metastatic breast cancer. But beyond PRS-343, PRS remains committed to generating a pipeline of unique immuno-oncology multispecific proteins. One example of this is PRS-342. Which is a bispecific drug candidate currently in preclinical development. PRS-342 contains the same CD137 building block as in PRS-343. This building block is genetically linked via an Fc portion of an antibody to another Anticalin that potently targets Glypican-3 or GPC-3, a tumor target highly upregulated in hepatocellular carcinoma as well as other cancers. As with PRS-343, we have confirmed tumor-dependent T-cell activation with PRS-342 ex vivo. PRS-342 not only represents another therapeutic opportunity in a cancer where the worldwide unmet need is great, but it also demonstrates the platform nature or the repeatability of PRS's tumor-localized co-stimulatory approach. And we believe that this platform nature of our multi-specifics capabilities is also going to be a valuable driver in the context of partnerships. We remain committed to creating value through partnerships, and our December 2015 collaboration agreement with Roche in immuno-oncology is a prime example of this commitment. Under the Roche agreement, Curis received an upfront licensing fee of about $6.5 million, plus fully funded research fees for Curis to discover, characterize, and optimize NK-based drug candidates against an undisclosed target from Roche. I want to remind everyone that this undisclosed target is completely independent of the targets Curis has been pursuing internally, including CD137. Nonetheless, in this collaboration, Roche and Curis will evaluate different drug formats against this undisclosed target and advance them through preclinical development, with Roche being responsible for IND-enabling activities, clinical development, and worldwide marketing of any resulting products. The collaboration could total for Curis more than $400 million U.S. in milestone payments, excluding royalties, and the majority of those milestone payments are related to the clinical development of derived candidates. We believe this partnership represents the first of multiple future IO-focused alliances for Curis as we continue to discover and characterize NK-LIND against additional high-value IO targets as building blocks for bi- and multi-specific therapeutic product candidates. Roche is one of several value partners that we have, and I would also like to mention that our existing partnerships with Big Pharma are continuing to deliver fruitful milestone payments. In 2015, we received several $1 million from our partnerships with Sanofi and Daiichi Sankyo, with three programs now progressing through preclinical and early clinical development. Another key financial milestone that we achieved in 2015 was the completion of an underwritten offering of common stock that raised $28.3 million in gross proceeds, which coincided with a NASDAQ uplisting. Oppenheimer and JMP acted as the joint book-running managers, with Roth Capital and Trout Capital acting as co-managers. So I want to conclude with a summary of Curis' key objectives for 2016, which includes the completion of our first inpatient trial for PRS-080 in anemia, with the hope of demonstrating iron mobilization in our targeted patient population, the continued execution of IND readiness activities for both PRS-060 in asthma and PRS-343 in oncology, with the initiation of first-in-man trials for both programs anticipated for the first half of 2017. We also want to have the continued generation and rollout of preclinical data for our immuno-oncology multi-specifics franchise, which demonstrates differentiation over conventional antibody approaches. And then, of course, there's the potential for additional partnerships as further validation of the NK-LIND drug class. So this concludes the corporate update, and I'd now like to hand over to Darlene to guide you through our financial results for the 2015 fiscal year.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning again, everyone. Let me begin by saying that the company's financial results for the year ended December 31, 2015, were in line with our expectations. We recognized revenue of $2.9 million for the full year 2015, compared with $5.4 million in revenue for the full year 2014. This $2.5 million decrease in revenue was primarily due to $9.9 million in reduced R&D service revenue from the successful handoff of research programs to our partners in 2014, $0.7 million and $0.5 million in reduced milestone and upfront payment revenue, respectively, year over year, and a $0.4 million reduction in grant revenue. Research and development expenses were $8.2 million for the year ended December 31, 2015, as compared to $5.6 million for the 2014 prior year end. This $2.6 million increase in total R&D expenses year over year is primarily due to a $2.3 million increase for consulting expenses, lab supplies, and personnel costs associated with our 300 series IO programs in the fiscal year 15. Our PRS-060 asthma program increased by $0.4 million due to increased preclinical efforts involving research studies. Our PRS-080 anemia program increased by $0.2 million due to the Phase 1 clinical trial activity that began in late 2014 and was completed during 2015, as well as clinical manufacturing costs. Other R&D activities decreased by $0.3 million. Included in other R&D activities in the 2015 period is $0.6 million of license fee expense associated with the settlement of the TUM license arbitration for the period 2004 to 2012, which was offset by an estimated Australian R&D tax credit of $0.3 million and an additional reduction of expenses related to other de-emphasized R&D projects. The full year of 2015 also included $0.4 million in non-cash stock-based compensation expense as compared to approximately $8,000 in stock-based comp for the full year 14. General and administrative expenses were $8.4 million for the year ended December 31, 2015, as compared to $7 million for the 2014 full year. The increase of $1.4 million in G&A expense resulted primarily from $1.1 million increase in investor relations expense, directors and officers insurance premiums, and other fees associated with being a public company, and $0.1 million in tax-related expense. Personnel and travel-related costs increased by $0.6 million and were offset by a decrease of $0.6 million in lower consulting costs. Non-cash stock-based compensation expense increased by $0.2 million to $0.8 million for the full year 2015 as compared to $0.6 million for the full year 2014. The net loss was $14.1 million or 41 cents per share for the full year ended December 31, 2015 as compared to a net loss of $9.8 million or 71 cents per share for the year ended December 31, 2014. Now turning to the balance sheet, total cash and cash equivalents totaled $29.3 million for the year ended 2015 as compared to $18.5 million for the year ended December 2014. The cash increase was driven primarily by the company's common stock offering completed in July 2015, where we raised $25.8 million in net proceeds. This cash balance does not include the $6.5 million upfront payment from Roche, as that was received in January 2016. We believe with the expected revenues and current cash on hand, we have sufficient cash to operate the business and fund our research and development programs well into 2017. With that, I'll now turn the call back over to Steve.
Thanks again, Darlene. 2015 was a year of significant achievement for Pieris Pharmaceuticals. We raised substantial capital, expanded our senior team, established another validating large pharma collaboration while progressing our existing partnerships, and we announced positive phase one clinical data in one of our lead programs while rapidly advancing a preclinical pipeline of differentiated proprietary therapeutic proteins, two of which are in IND-enabling studies and currently forecasted to begin first-in-human trials in the first half of 2017. Before I conclude, I would like to thank the Pieris team for their outstanding and tireless work throughout the past year, and to reiterate my confidence in our management team's ability to execute on our strategic initiatives, building value for our shareholders over the long term. Thank you for joining us today and for your interest and your support. We would now like to open the call up to your questions.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate that your line is in the question queue, and you may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question at this time. Our first question comes from the line of Michael King with JMP. Please go ahead with your questions.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking the question. I got just a couple of quick ones. On 343, Steve, can you just talk about, with Holbrook Court's passing recently, what was the net effect of the management or the relationship between you and, Stanford University, or is that something that's reverted completely back to Pieris? Maybe you can give us a little input on that.
Sure, Mike. Happy to do so. So, again, at the outset, we want to express our condolences to the friends and family of Dr. Holbrook Court, who unfortunately passed away, after a long-term battle with disease. And I'd like to say that we had the pleasure of working with an IO luminary and leader for several months in 2015. We announced an advisory relationship with Dr. Court and a collaboration with his lab at Stanford University in the spring of 2015. What I can say is that we are very diversified across how we generate data. We have an amazing team internally, and we have multiple service providers and collaborators, particularly in immuno-oncology, as we are making major investments into this area. And I can say that even to date, although we had taken good counsel from Dr. Court, all of the data that we have generated and presented on in 2015 at the CRI conference, the triple conference at SITC, and all the data that we are going to be presenting at AACR come from sources independent of that formal relationship. And so although it is a very sad development, this in no way impacts our ability to execute on 343 either strategically or operationally. In terms of the collaboration agreement with Stanford, that is something we are discussing with them. Again, it does not impact our path to the clinic or overall trajectory of the program, and that's something that we will discuss in more detail with Stanford in due course.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I hope that answers your question.
Yes, and then just one more question on 343. When you enter the clinic, can you give us some idea of how much preclinical data you'll have and how long that will translate into when you're able to go into patients as far as treatment duration?
Well, so we're not going to reinvent the wheel in terms of first-in-patient oncology trials in IO. So I think the strategy you'll see Pieris pursuing is not going to be unlike the traditional biologics approaches in terms of protocol. What I can say is, as I mentioned, we've had very positive discussions with FDA. We are assembling a world-class clinical advisory board and network of advisors across, of course, regulatory, but the clinical trial design, and obviously then lining up multi-sites for this clinical trial. So we remain on track to have an IND filed and first-in-patient dosing in HER2-positive tumors on patients who would be refractory to standard of care or non-responsive to standard of care in the first half of 2017. Alongside of that, of course, will come a tox package that will allow for us to dose for the duration that we think is necessary to achieve, to test response rates in patients in a first-in-patient study.
Okay, yeah, that's great because I'm sure everyone listening knows that sometimes IO molecules take a while to exert their effect. And then just one quick question on 342. Can you describe the animal model that it was studied in? I'm just curious if this was sort of a PDX model with tumor injected in the animal's flank, or if whether it was done into the organ site. I'm just wondering if that if the molecule has the ability to appropriately access the tissue microenvironment. Thanks very much.
Sure. Okay, thanks, Mike. And so on PRS-342, again, which is a bispecific CD137 GPC3 targeting drug based purely on anticalins on those targets, the data we referenced in this presentation and have disclosed publicly are ex vivo T cell data, not yet in vivo data, which are working with GPC3 high tumor cell lines. What we are in the midst of doing, but haven't disclosed publicly for IP reasons primarily, are the in vivo activities that we are commencing. And I would expect after we receive the data later in the year and file an IP, we can have the opportunity potentially in the fall conference season, although there are no promises there, the fall immuno-oncology conferences, potentially to disclose those results more openly. But so far today, just to confirm, we have ex vivo T-cell data, which show, nonetheless, tumor dependent activation of T cells.
Okay, our next question comes from the line of Krista Mariah with Oppenheimer. Please go ahead with your questions. Christopher Mariah, please check if your line is muted.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the questions. Congratulations, Stephen and Darlene, on the year. Maybe to follow up on some of Mike's questions, you know, I see your AACR abstract here for 343. I was wondering if you could further expand perhaps a little bit on some of the preclinical models that you've worked on with respect to autoimmunity and sort of safety in mouse models with respect to that compound. You know, have you done any work in terms of some of those diabetic mouse models, et cetera?
Yeah, so thanks again, Christopher, for the question and for following us. Well, in terms of the data that we are going to be disclosing in a poster session at AACR, I think we're not really at liberty to talk about it openly until the data are publicly available, but the good news is it's just around the corner in the middle of April. To date, we have been focusing on oncology-related models as opposed to autoimmune-related aspects. I don't know if that directly answers your question, but what we absolutely believe is the differentiated approach that our bispecific will bring relative to plain vanilla monoclonal antibodies is our ability to have a focused tumor-dependent activation of T cells in the tumor bed. And that, we believe, will lead to a high differentiation over the antibodies that have been and are currently in clinical development.
Okay, absolutely. That makes sense. I'm just thinking, I mean, the opposite side of that, I guess, is non-tumor microenvironment activation of your molecule, which has led in some cases to toxicities with those targets. So I'm just wondering, you know, do we expect to see any preclinical data on that, or are we going to kind of just have to wait for human data there?
Well, one of the things that's important to keep in mind with our drug, which is different than at least one antibody in development, is the way we engage CD137 is in a non-competitive manner. And that's important because when our drug is bound to CD137, we preserve the ability to engage with CD137 ligand. And as we know, that CD137 is, of course, involved peripherally in immune surveillance. What we want to avoid is that our drug, when it is it will be a systemically administered agent, but it will preferentially traffic to the tumor. But until it gets there, and when it is not there, any CD137 engagement, we believe, will be in a non-competitive manner. And as that drug will not be clustered in the periphery, we do not expect to interfere with immune surveillance. That is an important homeostatic function. So what we have confirmed is that our drug is non-competitive, and we have confirmed the inability to activate T cells in solution compared to when clustered at the tumor site. We believe that that body of data actually goes a long way to supporting the avoidance of this immune suppression because it's a non-competitive engager in the periphery.
Okay, great. And then just maybe one last follow-up on the Roche partnership you guys signed earlier this year. And I know it's a little tough to talk about some of these things, but maybe just some general guidance. I mean, this sounds like it's for one compound, if I recall correctly. You received a milestone to initiate this. Are there other potential compounds Roche might be looking at, and would you receive milestones for that? And then two, with respect to the first compound, when do you think, the next potential milestone payment could occur? And do you include that in your cash guidance? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So on the first question, the scope of programs that could come out of this collaboration, currently it's a defined target collaboration, and collaboration activities, discovery activities are already underway. They started in January. There's a potential, because of the multi-specifics capabilities of the Anticalin technology, to have multi-specific anticalins against different epitopes across that same target, number one. And number two, the ability to link up one or more of those anticalins to other therapeutic proteins, which could, for example, include antibodies in Roche's pipeline. Now, we're not at liberty to talk beyond that about those molecules, but I can say that what probably attracted Roche most to this collaboration is our ability to have high hit rates against different epitopes across any given target, the speed with which we do it, and the versatility of combining different anticarins through a genetic linkage, either to each other or to other therapeutic proteins. And in terms of timelines, well, I'd like to use our CD137 lead program, PRS-343, as a good example of our timelines. We initiated that program in April or May of 2014 from scratch. And we will be first in patient about 3 years later. So we can go, and we believe confidently, we can go from idea to patient in 3 years. At least we can do that. We've done that on our own, or we plan to do that on our own. There are preclinical milestone opportunities within the collaboration with Roche. We haven't broken those out publicly. So if you can think of in a very favorable scenario, but I believe it's achievable, kick off to patient in 3 years. We can understand where a phase one milestone payment and maybe classic preclinical milestone payments could become due. And they are not forecasted into our cash reach projections.
But with one exception, the $6.5 million upfront payment is included in our cash projection.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But no contingent milestone
beyond
payment.
Beyond that, correct, yes.
Got it. Makes a lot of sense. Thanks for the caller. Congrats.
Thank you.
Thank you. And once again, as a reminder, you may press *1 on your telephone keypad to ask a question. Our next question comes from the line of Elmer Piros with Roth Capital. Please go ahead with your questions.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. Steve, in the AACR abstract, I didn't see that you listed whether you compared the anti-tumor effect of 343 with an anti-HER2 antibody. Have you done that?
We are of course doing that, and we have different controls. Different isotype controls and different formats of our drug, which have different formats of our CD137 linked to different parts of the HER2 targeting antibody. The data, I think we have to wait until the abstract or the poster comes out to comment in detail on the data, again, out of respect to AACR's guidelines. But we certainly appreciate that that's a very, very important aspect. And those are data that, of course, we are exploring. And I understand the nature of the question. And I think that what you'll find is that our drug will show a differentiated approach over not only CD137 antibodies, but in general over your plain vanilla HER2 targeted antibodies.
Okay, thank you. And moving on to the 080 anti-hepcidin program. Two questions there, please. What sort of preclinical tox studies are you undertaking to increase your ability to dose longer than 28 days? And when would they mature? Would they be in time for when you are ready to expand dosing?
Right. So currently, a longer tox than a 28-day tox is not on critical path to the long-term development of this program. What we are seeking to achieve first and foremost is to assess whether this drug at commercially relevant doses can drive hemoglobin levels, and we believe we are on path to observe that in a very cost and time-efficient manner, with the ability to look by the end of this year at iron mobilization in patients as a function of single dose in a dose and time-dependent manner, and that will directly inform the multi-dose phase of the trial, which we would then seamlessly plan to enter into and then have in a very, we hope, rapid manner data on hemoglobin, which would be a very good go-no-go decision for the continuation of this program, as that is a very meaningful, clinically relevant endpoint for this program, again, the middle of 2017.
So if you make a go decision then would you have to catch up with additional talks if longer dosing is required?
Well, I think the long-term development progress of this, long-term development of this program will ultimately require an increased tox package or a larger tox package, definitely, as is normal. As I said, right now, the current tox strategy allows us to do what we want to do, and we do not see that longer-term tox study is critical path to continue progression of the program.
Okay. And last question, Steve. Where is the single ascending and multiple ascending dose trial takes place? Because I couldn't find it on clinicaltrials.gov.
This is taking place in Germany under the German BfArM, and we have contracted currently with three sites. We have a significant number of patients identified, and the good news is that these are patients who have been coming into the dialysis center for quite some time. So unlike another type of indication where maybe it's a cancer patient comes in for the first time, there are patients who the investigators have already identified, and so that is actually a very positive aspect of working in dialysis centers. The three sites currently in Germany, and we may be enrolling more sites, but we don't think it's even required to maintain the timelines that we've set forth.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Our next question comes from the line of David Bouts with Zacks Investment Research. Please go ahead with your questions.
Hi, good morning. I got a question about 343. So as we're thinking about when it moves into the clinic and the potential number of patients that could be treated with the compound, now I understand that patients are going to be screened for HER2 levels in the tumor, but will there be any type of screening for either T cell levels in the tumor and or CD137?
Hey, Dave, that's a great question. The short answer is that while we will be screening based on HER2 levels, we do not currently expect to screen on T-cell or CD137 positive levels of CD137 positive T-cells. However, we have been very careful, and we're speaking with the leading medical oncologists across these key tumor types for the drug in real time, and of course, pouring through the literature. And the way we have selected these tumors on our short list is not only levels of HER2 and non-responsiveness to standard of care, but also the propensity of an immune component, namely CD137 positive TILs. And so although we probably will not screen for CD137 positivity in those actual patients, based on the numbers that are reported in the literature, we're confident that a fair amount of those patients will have that immune component to drive the mode of action of our drug. And that specifically includes metastatic breast, invasive bladder, and HER2-positive gastric cancer. And there are others, but
okay.
those are key tumors that fit the profile for this drug, in our opinion.
Okay, great. Yeah, that makes sense. Appreciate you taking the question.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, David.
Thank you, and it seems that we have no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the floor back over to management.
Great, thank you. So in conclusion, we look forward to building in the residual 2016 on what we've accomplished in 2015. We're well positioned financially, and we have great drug candidates and partners. I'd like to lastly thank our talented team, without whose experience, intellect, and passion, we could not execute on this development journey together. It's a team we do look to expand during 2016 as we continue to grow our team in Boston, which will complement our excellent team of scientists in Germany. So we look forward to keeping you updated on our progress, and we thank you again for joining the call. Have a great day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect your lines at this time, and thank you for your participation.